Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State. The best outcomes for treating cancer come from early detection. The James Cancer Diagnostic Center is designed to provide rapid evaluation and a clear diagnosis to those who suspect they have cancer. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/diagnosticcenter.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. This is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Rex Alba, a home chef from Columbus, won over the hearts of anyone who watched the most recent season of The Great American Recipe on PBS and on WOSU-TV. His kind demeanor, enthusiasm for cooking, and love for his competitors shone through on the TV screen. Rex has also appeared in a John Travolta movie, competed on American Ninja Warrior, and is the president of the Philippine American Society of Central Ohio. And he joins us today. Rex Alba, thanks for being here.
Good morning, Amy, and to all your listeners and viewers of All Sides. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. So you came to our attention because WOSU-TV just aired the most recent season of The Great American Recipe, and you were a competitor. But how did you end up on the show?
So I was kind of bored last year, 2 years ago, and then I tried to look for anything that I can compete and try to challenge myself on cooking because I competed physically, but this time I wanted to challenge my cooking skills. So I just applied for like five cooking competitions online.
Oh, that's funny. Okay.
And then I heard from PBS, but they weren't casting that time, so I had to wait for probably about 2-3 months. Then they emailed me to reapply. And then, so I reapplied, and it took them about 3 months to, you know, to really finalize casting. It was not easy to get in.
It was a long process. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, did you consider yourself a chef, a cook? What did you call yourself prior to sitting down and writing all these applications to be on a cooking show?
I just put a chef, cook. Mm-hmm. You know, because I've been cooking since I was young, inspired by my mom. And even back in the Philippines, I had a small cafeteria to help out the family when my mom died. So, and that really enhanced my cooking. And moved here in the U.S. 20 years ago. It's just me and my wife, and that really enhanced my cooking skills.
Now, the recipes you made on the show all focused on your heritage. You were born in the Philippines. But what brought you here to Ohio 20 years ago, you said?
Yeah, so my wife is a nurse at the Wexner Medical Center. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I got on board here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So I'm a physical therapist by profession, but I wasn't practicing physical therapy back home. So when we arrived here, and I took my board exams, and I'm also a physical therapist right now. So, yeah.
That's your day job.
And yes.
Being a TV show competitor by night. Yeah. So, You cook Filipino food. What is the essence of Filipino food? Any standout flavors that you always think of?
So it's a combination of we were colonized by different nations, and we always have this story behind each dish. So I think it's more on the story than behind than the flavor. For me, it's like every dish that we serve, there's a story, and there's people that the story behind the people that's making the dish. But with the flavor, we have a mixture of sourness, a little spice, and some bitterness.
In the first episode, you put your own spin on something from where you're from. That was the challenge. And so you leaned into the Skyline Chili vibe for Cincinnati. Tell us how you made that dish your own.
I tried to put in some Filipino hot dog. We have a red hot dog in the Philippines, which is kind of popular back home. That's what I put the spin. And also I combined with a cacao. It's a cocoa, a real cacao that I grated, and that's what I use in the show. And I was really debating what to use for that episode, and I ended up doing the chili and carne dog.
Did they tell you all the prompts beforehand so that you would come prepared with the right recipes?
Yeah, so we were informed like 2 months ahead of the show on what they need for the episode. So we had to write down the recipes, what tools to use. So they prepared everything for us. And the good thing about the show is they also try to make sure they accommodate the tools that we need. So we came prepared when we started the show.
Now, that episode we were just talking about with the chili, Al Roker was the special guest judge. So you got to cook for him. What was that like?
It was amazing. I mean, I love Al Roker, and he's a legend in on TV. Yeah. And we were surprised because we never, in the past past season, we never saw any big celebrities come in the mm-hmm. show. And we were like, oh, wow, this is just the beginning. And we were up to a great start.
Now, in that same episode, you made a rice cake that Judge Tiffany said she would never forget. Mm. That is an amazing compliment. How did that make you feel?
Oh, it feels really good because I was able to show what a rice cake how we make rice cake back home. At the same time, I wasn't expecting that compliment from her because she's really, you know, she's really honest on her yeah. on her opinions, and yeah. and for her to really give me that compliment really felt good.
Now, you filmed the show, I don't know, it was in Nashville, right? So yes. Did you have to like move to Nashville for a few weeks?
So we were there for over 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yes. So okay. We were booking a hotel, and people didn't know that on a reality show like this, you're not allowed to have visitors in the hotel. You're not allowed to go out in the hotel. So we have a production assistant staying in the hotel with us, and we need to ask permission every time we, you know, go somewhere, but not just inside, even just inside a hotel.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So, yeah, we text them our what food we want. So they just bring it to our room, or sometimes we eat together. But it was really a secret. So our life was just hotel set. We were out together as a group once, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. This is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking to a finalist from the most recent season of The Great American Recipe, Columbus's own Rex Alba. From watching the show, The Great American Recipe, I feel like it's not quote-unquote American food, because what was made on that show was from so many cultures. Do you think the show helps American food be viewed as more than hamburgers and hot dogs?
Yeah, I think America. It's we need to be diverse as Americans. I mean, we were built on different immigrants, and I believe the show really portrayed the real essence of what America is. And some people may, you know, made that comment, that like, mm-hmm. but I believe the majority of us that wants America to be like this appreciated the concept of the show.
Yeah, it made me think of a social studies teacher I had in high school. She didn't like it when people called the United States a melting pot, because she always said that the United States was more like a stew, because a melting pot blends everything together, but a stew, the items all keep their own shape. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I definitely agree.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they let us do our own stuff regarding our background or our culture, but at the same time, we also tried to, you know, state as true Americans.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did you and the other contestants, you know, do you feel like you bonded with them? Did you guys become a stew together?
Oh, yeah. It was amazing because they didn't show it on the show, but I really cried hard even the first week when Carlos and Bri was sent home.
Aww.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I can't believe it. I was like, these people are so great. And until now, we still, we still have a group chat, and we were planning on like having a reunion together.
Oh, that's nice. Now, sadly, you did not win, mm-hmm. but you were a finalist. Mm-hmm. So congratulations on that.
Thank you.
What's your favorite memory? What will you always take with you from being on the show?
Probably the fun times we had, especially Kobe. He's a really fun guy.
Yeah.
He has some videos and clips that he tries to impersonate all of us. He's a good comedian. So I mean the bonding with all the fellow cooks, you know, it's the most important thing. And plus the experience I got to have on cooking in front of lots of cameras in front mm-hmm. of you, and it really developed me as a person, as a cook.
Whenever you were doing the episodes, would you cook like all day? They make it seem like, because they say next week, but it was just you were doing it day after day. Is that right?
Yes, it's mostly one day per episode, but mm-hmm. on the final episode, we spent 2 days.
Okay.
And we had our special guest, and we didn't even know about that.
Yeah, so you truly didn't know that your wife was coming to be a special guest?
No, because I just spoke with her the night before. But she told me they kept on communicating with her a week before, like, Rex is doing well, but in case he makes it to the finals, are you able to fly? So they tried to communicate with your loved ones, and that was amazing.
So she was there in Nashville, and you were talking to her on the phone, and you didn't know she was there?
No, she arrived the day of the filming.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so okay. From the airport to set.
Yeah. Now,
you had to probably keep a lot of secrets about what happened, right? I mean, your wife was there for the finale because she ate the food, so she knew. But how long did you have to not be able to talk about the show?
So we filmed it September last year, and we were not able to spill anything up until they announced the cooks last July, June, July. And then not until the final cook-off, we were not able to share any off-the-scene pictures or videos.
Was that hard to keep a secret?
It is hard, especially with your friends.
They were like, "Where have you been?" Oh, I don't know.
It is really hard. I didn't expect it to be that way.
Yeah. What do you plan on doing next? Because, I mean, watching you cook all of this food, it looks so amazing. You look like you were having fun. Are you going to open a restaurant or something?
I'm more like sharing my recipes. I have a vlog, Bisdak Chef. Bisdak is like a true Visayan or from where I came from, the Philippines, is Visayas. Mm. So I have a Facebook, YouTube called Bisdak Chef. I also shared on my Rex Alba page on Facebook and Instagram. But, you know, I hope someday I'll have my own brand of cookwares or kitchenwares, I mean. Mm. And hopefully try to introduce more Filipino cuisine and throughout the world.
So are you thinking more cookware in a cookbook or something like that?
Yeah, some sort of like that. But because I've noticed there's a lot of things we need to improve in our kitchen, and hopefully I can establish my brand of my own.
Oh, great. Okay. So no restaurant, though. I was hoping for it to be able to come see you at a restaurant.
I've tried having a small cafeteria back home when I was younger, and it's I don't think at this age, I don't think I'll be able to do that. But maybe hopefully I can help somebody build one for them.
So before I completely run out of time, I have to ask you about something you put in your bio because it made me smile. You played a featured role in a John Travolta movie, the movie I Am Wrath. Tell me about that.
So I auditioned just doing a cattle call, but then I ended up having the role as the Korean gangster.
Oh.
But when the director saw me on set, I'm kind of small, so he's like, he didn't expect me to do it. So I had to audition on set.
Ah.
Yeah, there's three of us. So even though I already got the role, I still had to re-audition.
He's like, "Prove to me you can do this."
I know. Yeah. So it was hard, and but I ended up getting the role, and he introduced me to John and the crew, and it was so much fun. I didn't really expect it.
Yeah, that makes me feel like I need to check out the movie I Am Wrath.
It's on Netflix right now.
Okay, all right. And then you were also on American Ninja Warrior, which you mentioned earlier. So you're a man of many talents. Did you enjoy that show?
It was fun. I mean, I tested my physical skills because I gained weight when we moved here in the U.S. because, you know, food is cheap.
Oh, the food.
But I had some symptoms of hypertension, and I really want to change my lifestyle. So after I changed my lifestyle, I try to challenge what I can do to it. Mm. And that's how I ended up in the show.
So you said for what's next, you know, the cookware idea and sharing your recipes, but do you want more TV in the future? Are you going to apply for another cooking show, or are you going to go back to American Ninja Warrior?
Definitely cooking.
Cooking.
Yes.
Okay. Focus on the cooking.
Yes, definitely.
Okay. He's smiling. He has a secret. And then finally, you are currently the president of the Philippine American Society of Central Ohio. What is the Filipino culture like in Columbus?
So before we weren't this many, but now, I mean, there's a lot of Filipinos coming in here in Central Ohio, and I'm really proud and so thankful that I was given the opportunity to lead the group. And it's 50 years here in Ohio, so it's been a long time that this organization has been established, and we try to promote our culture. At the same time, we this is for the future generation. That way, they don't forget that once you know, in their lifetime, there were Philippine immigrants that started this, and at the same time, we also want them to instill in their minds that our Filipino cuisine, our culture as Filipinos.
Well, my family and I had a great time watching you on the show. We watched it together as a family. It was super fun to get to watch you. My kids cheered for you because they're, you know, from Columbus, so they're Columbus friend. They were all on Team Rex. But my daughter was really also on Team Fran. she really loved Fran. What do you think you're going to take away from this whole experience, the Great American Recipe, being featured on PBS? I mean, what was your favorite part?
Aside from being able to show what the Filipino cuisine is, and also trying to show how, because if you notice on the show, I took a lot of risk, mm-hmm. but
you made complicated things, man.
Yeah, but that's what I want to show, how Filipinos manage the grit And as a third world country, we have all this issues and problems, but then we still manage to smile and try to be composed. And that's what I want to show on the shows.
You just seem so happy the whole time there. Like you were were you really smiling on set the whole time?
I was happy, but the last cook-off, I was so tired, if you saw me. it was so tough cooking for 3 hours and at the same time cooking everything from scratch. It was tough.
Well, that final dessert you made looks beautiful.
Yes.
Absolutely beautiful. So,
and you can try that. We have a Philippine American Society of Central Ohio picnic, annual picnic on Sunday at the High Banks in Lewis Center.
Really?
From 12 noon to 4, we will have that halo halo there.
You're going to make, oh, wow.
Yes, we'll
have
a halo.
That's so fun.
And it's going to be fun. We'll have lots of Filipino vendors too. So hopefully you can join us.
Oh, that's so fun. Well, for our listeners, I really encourage you to watch Rex on The Great American Recipe if you haven't. It is on PBS Passport, so you can check it out there. Rex Alba, finalist from The Great American Recipe, thank you for joining us today on All Sides.
Thank you so much, Amy.
And coming up, we're going to meet a woman who's working to improve the lives of immigrant and refugee families here in Central Ohio. That's when Fascinating Ohio from All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. Ohio ranks among the top nationally for refugee intake. Our Helpers is a woman-led nonprofit on a mission to improve the lives of immigrant and refugee families in Central Ohio. Dorothy Hassan is the CEO of Our Helpers, as well as a professor, a researcher, and a community organizer. And she joins us today. Welcome to All Sides, Professor Hassan.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation.
So you are the CEO of Our Helpers.
Yes, ma'am.
Tell us what Our Helpers does.
Sure. So we are a nonprofit officed on the north side of Columbus on a mission to improve the lives of immigrant and refugee families here in Central Ohio. I usually am quite particular about saying officed on the north side because our work extends through all of Central Ohio. Mm-hmm. But we just that's where our office is. We have direct service office right off of 161, but we also have a community free store that's off of Morse Road.
Okay. When did Our Helpers become what it is today? How long has it been around?
Sure. So Hoden Muhammad is the founder mm-hmm. of Our Helpers, and that work started in 2013, mm-hmm. where she, as a Somali refugee mom, recognize the gap in services for people in the community and started just helping. And that's where the name came from. People were calling her in Somali the helper. Mm. So she organized the nonprofit organization, Our Helpers.
And what I said was that Ohio ranks among the top nationally for refugee intake. So tell me about the type of people, where they're coming from, and who you're helping.
Sure. So as far as Central Ohio, we are home to the largest resettled Nepali refugee mm-hmm. community, and we're home to the second largest Somali refugee resettled community. And then there's all of a whole bunch of other bits and communities that have also come to Central Ohio because there's welcoming infrastructure here. So the people that we serve mostly in with Our Helpers, our numbers fluctuate as, you know, the dynamic needs of the community. But last year, we served a majority community from Afghanistan, Algeria, Sudan, Congo, and Somalia.
How did you get involved in our helpers?
That's a funny story. I've always been doing nonprofit work. My family and I moved to Ohio in 2012. And I started, when I started my master's degree in TESOL, after spending 10 years abroad as an expatriate, I lived for 6 years in Yemen and another 4 in Egypt. So it was just a natural fit when we came to Central Ohio to be working with the immigrant community. Mm-hmm. I started out teaching English as a second language, and then I was Laura Berger Abbas. Was serving as the COO of Our Helpers in 2020, did a lot of great work there, and in 2022 presented me with the opportunity to work with Our Helpers as CEO.
What are some of the daily tasks you're involved in? I mean, you're trying to run the organization. Are you talking with immigrants and refugees every day?
Yeah, absolutely. As CEO, I have those regular office administrative responsibilities. But just yesterday was an awesome experience. I was walking into the office already late for a county advisory meeting, and there was a gentleman that was in the lobby. And just from good morning, he felt inclined to tell me that he was looking for help. Mm-hmm. I noticed that the way that he asked for help, that English may not be his first language. I asked him what language he spoke. He told me Nepali, and I invited him into the office, connected with another person at a different agency, told her I needed a Nepali translator on the phone so that we could help this man, and turns out we were able to get another sister friend on the phone. She was translating, and this gentleman needed help reaching out and getting internet service in his home so that his daughter could do her homework.
Oh, wow.
So it was an hour spent looking online, finding the best deals because he had a budget. So we were able to get him connected to Spectrum with a really great online deal. And after this, I get to give him a call and make sure that his modem kit, self-installation kit arrived at his home today and that he's all set.
So that's just an example of someone who knew what they needed but didn't quite know how to get it. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And this is Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking with Dorothy Hassan, CEO of Our Helpers. How are you funded? Because being a nonprofit nowadays is not easy.
Ooh, the pink elephant in the room. Mm-hmm. Funding is always a sensitive conversation. And Our Helpers, historically, we have depended on competitive grants. So we are funded through the City of Columbus. We also get funding from the state of Ohio, and we also have private donors.
Have you found any pushback or any problems with funding? I mean, there's the community, the immigrant and refugee community faces a lot of challenges, especially in the past year.
Yeah, absolutely. Our biggest challenge right now is that the people are getting, we're having to deal with both this far left and this far right, that we have people who are busting at the gills to support us in any way possible. Mm-hmm. And then we have some of our usual donors who are looking to be a little bit scaled back and to be more anonymous. So that means with that anonymity, they're not giving as much. As far as our city and state funding, there are delays, huge delays in the funding that was available before, and just the whole uncertain terrain that we're in, especially serving immigrant and refugee families here in Central Ohio, makes it a challenging time for all of us in the services and the programs that we're able to roll out and the funding that we can count on.
Yeah, and I know your organization does a lot of different things, from helping someone find the internet to mentorship. But Have you had to change a little bit? Do you have people coming to you and they're worried about deportation? They're worried about ICE. Do you have to give them advice about how to handle themselves?
So since November of 2024, we started convening what we lovingly call CORN. And CORN stands for Central Ohio Rapid Response Network. Mm-hmm. And like I said, we've been convening since November 2024 because we knew that this administration is one that does their best to roll out their best promises, best used very lightly. So we knew that the people that we love and serve were going to be in some real predicaments. So with CORN, we are setting out to make sure that not only the vulnerable population of immigrant and refugee families is informed and empowered, but also the stakeholders that serve them. So we have, for example, right after this, we have a weekly meeting of local stakeholders, and we come together, we go over the national updates, regional updates, and also just some local action points about how everyone can make sure that they're offering the best support that they can for the vulnerable population of immigrant and refugees that we have here in Central Ohio.
Earlier, you mentioned helping people from Nepal, and there's a lot of political turmoil in that country. Are there people who are trying to come here, and are they unable to because of the climate right now?
Absolutely. Something that the general public does rarely understands is how long it actually takes for a refugee to go through that process and actually arrive in the United States as a resettled refugee. We have heard from families that have spent up to 20 years in a refugee camp just waiting for that processing. So when these quick policies come that put a halt in that process, imagine having gone through the process of 20 years. And for example, you've done all the vetting, all the everything. And at the last notch, there's this quick policy that's disconnected from the work that you've put in and the waiting that maybe even your family has done on the other side that prevents you from reuniting with your family or just finally starting a life of stability.
You are the CEO of Our Helpers. You also have a PhD in philosophy, and you're an adjunct professor for eCornell. Tell us a little bit more about your academic background, and are you still teaching right now?
Sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm an educator at heart. I talked a little bit about my life experience as an expatriate. That's actually where I started teaching. But I am one of those few persons that when you ask me at 10 years old, what do you want to be when you grow up? I always wanted to be a professor. Hmm. I always found richness in learning and sharing that knowledge. So currently I teach diversity, equity, and inclusion. I teach counteracting unconscious bias. And with eCornell, I teach to professionals who are usually preaching to the choir. So it's usually people who have actually chosen to invest in knowing more about how they can create inclusive environments at work and in their communities. So it aligns very well with what I do every day.
With all of these cutbacks with DEI work, have you had to change your class at all? Has Cornell asked you to?
I mean, I keep up with the news just like everyone else because I'm just an adjunct professor. I don't I'm not privy to any of the admin decisions, but so far they're standing their ground on the importance of diversity, equity, and inclusion. So far I still got a job.
Got it. you are also a community organizer. You've been a part of, besides Our Helpers, Forward Step Education, the Muslim American Society of Columbus. I'm sure there's more that we're missing, but what drives you to be so involved? Most people just sit around and don't join everything.
I mean, you know, I can't remember which social media outlet it was on, and it was years ago, but it said something like, get paid to do what you were going to do, what you would do for free. Mm. That's it. Like, I was going to do this for free. Mm. I am the eldest sibling of just one. So I always like to say that I've always led with oldest sibling energy.
Yeah, that older daughter energy. Yeah,
yeah, I gotcha. Absolutely.
I gotcha.
So that is it. Like, I've always just cared. And I myself know what a joy it is and how warm it feels inside to be surrounded by people who love me, who support me. And I just want to pass that on.
Now, as if you weren't busy enough, you also decided to run for Hilliard City Council. Is that right?
That is right.
What made you decide to pursue that?
Truth be told, I always thought I would be pretty good at politics, actually. And it was a real honor to have the support of the community to dip my toe in that. Mm-hmm. Like, it was wonderful. And again, it really aligned with who I am and what I do. So I don't feel like running for city council was outside of who I am. It was a wonderful, wonderful experience. And it was just, again, just being in community. When we talk about politics, I think that for a very long time, we stopped showing up to practices. We stopped showing up and doing the drills because we thought we were winning. And I just wanted to be a part of the reminder that democracy takes work. We got to show up. Show up for who you stand for as a person. Show up for your neighbors. Show up for your community. And as we watch the news every day, we got to show up for this nation. And what side of history we want to be on.
Now, you didn't make it onto Hilliard City Council.
Facts.
Do you plan on trying again or a different office? Like, where's politics fit into your brain here?
That's a funny question. And of course, everyone asks that question. And I myself am very eager to see 15 years from now when we look back at all of these interviews and say, oh, she said she would, but she didn't. Or she said she would never. And look at her now. So,
yeah.
So, I am still very much in my intentional yes season. Mm-hmm. So anything is possible. I will tell you that it was through the campaign that I learned that I too have a social battery. Mm. And the work that our elected officials are doing for us is nothing short of God's work. Mm. Just the all day of listening to people, engaging with people, showing up different places. I don't know if I'm built for that type of God's work yet.
So a solid maybe on the future of politics for you.
You said it, not me.
All right. I'll take the solid maybe. What of everything that you're involved in, I'm sure that being the CEO of Our Helpers is probably one of your favorites. But I just what is your favorite thing that makes your heart the most warm and fuzzy?
Our community free store.
Oh, yeah. Tell me about that. OK.
Our community free store happened because we got a $500,000 in kind donation from the Walmart that closed on South High Street.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And the only way that we were actually able to accept the donation was because my husband has a trucking company. So after really, really strong vetting, and I'm telling you, I was on the spot and was texting board members like, hey, I don't know what we're being vetted for, but if anybody can support me, get down here. Mm. They got down here. And then the woman who was closing down that store wanted to make sure that the inventory that she was able to donate got to the community. And she told us, okay, you can take the rest of this inventory. And I was like, I love a challenge.
Wow.
Called my husband and told him, hey, could you bring a 53-foot drive-in down here to me? And he was like, I have no idea what you're up to. I don't know why you do this. I'll be down there in 25 minutes.
You're like, I need a truck. Okay.
Yeah. So we had board members, took my kids out of school for the week. We had some community friends. We packed it all up, put it on that 53-foot dry van, and realized that this was not a pop-up shop inventory. Like, we could really, really do something with this.
Yeah.
Held it on the dry van. Laura Berger Bass especially helped us to find space in the north side. And that's how we came up with the community free store that is open on Mondays and Tuesdays. And the real objective is to decrease the triggers of scarcity trauma for families who have had to do for so long with so little. We have, you know, free vegetables and produce on that strand of healthy food. But we don't often talk about just the trauma that comes when you go to bed and there's nothing in the pantry for tomorrow, or you know that there's no food for the rest of the week. So we have food, and we also have small household items, and just trying to make sure that we're able to provide stability for, again, those families who haven't had that luxury for a very long time.
Well, thank you, Dorothy Hassan, CEO of Our Helpers, as well as a professor, a researcher, a community organizer. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you again for the invitation.
And coming up, we're going to meet the author of a new book that is looking to whether or not or when you should allow your child to have a phone. That's when Fascinating Ohio continues from all sides on 89.7 NPR News.
Rare to find a podcast that can actually change your life. But when the show's called Life Kit, that's kind of the whole point. I'm Mariel Segarra. 3 times a week on the Life Kit podcast, we guide you through a topic we could all use help with, from personal development to healthy living to managing your dinero, with takeaways so you can start living what you learn right away. Escucha el Life Kit podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. And this is Fascinating Ohio, a show from All Sides and WOSU, where we introduce you to people from the Buckeye State with an interesting story to tell. One of the biggest flashpoints in parenting society today is screen time. And as our kids get older, that screen time debate turns into a device debate. When do you get your kid a phone? Anyone with a child above the age of 9 or 10 is struggling with this question. And whether you have kids or not, chances are you have an opinion about it, because everybody has an opinion about kids and phones. Our next guest says we have unintentionally deprived our younger generation of experiences that we grew up with. And that's what author Adam Ferguson is conveying in his recent book, The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone. The book includes a list of 50 tasks that a child should do before they are given a phone. Adam Ferguson joins us today. Thanks for joining us.
Amy, thank you.
So the book has a list of things that a child should do before they're given a phone. Is the book's audience, is it intended for parents or for children to read, or both?
It's really for the kids. Mm-hmm. It's kind of a guidebook for coming of age, if you will. But the, you know, I expect it's going to interest parents more than kids.
The title, at least.
Well, yeah, and just because it's a list of things between the kid and a phone.
Yeah, yeah. So we can go through several things on the list throughout this conversation. But basically, you're running through some life skills. For example, number one is do laundry. Why does a kid need to do laundry before they can have a phone?
Well, I think, you know, the impetus for the book and the list was really... It was walking into some of my daughter's social events and seeing 10 little girls all heads down kind of staring at screens and thinking about my own childhood and the differences between these experiences, and thinking about the pendulum, how it had shifted from kind of the physical world to the digital world and how much the void that a lot of these kids spend hours a day in. And then I was thinking about the experiences that they're not getting as a result. So, I mean, yeah, some of them are basic life skills, like learning how to do the laundry, learning how to, you know, cook dinner for the family. Some of them are more advanced life skills, like learning to build a fire, you know, learning how to run a 5K or swim 100 meters. And then some of them are a little more spiritual, like, you know, going on a weekend road trip with one of your parents or visiting a cemetery. But these are all experiences that have the kid kind of engage with just the physical world. And that's how we learned when we were growing up. And I worry that just the trial and error is not, the kids aren't getting it as much these days.
Yeah, the example you gave, I think I read it on your LinkedIn page, maybe, where you said that you walked into your daughter's sleepover, and instead of them all chit-chatting and the way and like or watching a movie, they were all looking at their phones.
Yeah, right? there were tablets, there were Nintendo Switches, there were one or two phones because it was her fifth grade sleepover.
Yeah, everyone had a different device. Yes,
right, and it was quiet.
Yeah,
you know, and that's kind of what got me to walk downstairs, just the quiet in the house.
Too quiet.
It's a parent trigger. Yeah.
Yeah.
And when I walked down and saw that, I was like, man, you know, just what happened to childhood? I miss going out into the world and getting scuffed up. And
because I remember, like, for my sleepovers, playing truth or dare, you know, playing light as a feather, stiff as a board, all that stuff. So that wasn't happening.
Right. Well, yeah. Confronting boredom.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's a big imagination trigger for kids. Mm. And so a lot of these experiences are meant to kind of provoke some of that.
One that I found interesting on your list was number 39, break a minor law.
Oh, that's one of my favorites.
Yeah. You want kids to be rule breakers?
Yeah, I think that's how progress gets done, you know, by looking at systems and questioning authority. You know, I'm pretty explicit about what not to do in that situation. But, you know, rules that your parents have made that you think are maybe unjust, one or two. Your school, you know, like, what are you questioning? Why are you questioning it? And I will give you permission to break that law. I do say at the end, there might be consequences, and that's part of the story.
Yeah, yeah, you're not telling someone to steal a car there. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we're talking about the book, The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone, with author Adam Ferguson. So how did it come to your attention that other parents were needing this support in talking about kids and phones?
I think, you know, obviously on the sidelines of playing fields and, you know, just it's a common understood problem. Mm-hmm. You know, I think even Jonathan Haidt had a really powerful book, The Anxious Generation, talking from a data perspective, you know, the anxiety kids are dealing with these days, the depression, the sense of isolation. Mm-hmm. Even the self-harm, I mean, all these statistics have picked up and you can kind of like demarcate it specifically to that period of 2010 to 2015 when phones really started to disseminate mm-hmm. throughout society. And I think that, you know, I'm trying to give us some grace as a culture because this is new and we're experiencing growing pains mm-hmm. And that's okay. But I think, you know, you're starting to see schools regulate things, which is great. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably more regulations down the road that will protect kids from, you know, the unseen consequences of what we didn't expect with this technology.
Now, spoiler alert, I'm going to give away the last chapter because your final answer is age 14. Mm. You say that a kid has to turn 14 before they get a phone. But there's some nuance to it. Can you explain that nuance that you have in the chapter?
Yes. Task number 50 is turn 14. And I think that's eighth grade. You know, I would love to, I say in that write up, you know, I would love for you to be kept from spending a lot of your time in technology up to that point. But recognizing that, you know, kids all grow up at different ages of maturity and speeds. And every parent's got to make that call on their own. So it's a little bit of a dad joke, but it's also it's a good guide point, I think, for a lot of parents to think about waiting until eighth grade.
You have three kids yourself. Did they all pass the test, the 50?
Yeah. So the idea came to me during my daughter's age. It really kind of blossomed when she's my youngest. So mm-hmm. she's in seventh grade now.
So she's not 14. All right.
No, correct. Yeah. She's a very mature, almost 13. My boys are in high school. They're juniors and seniors. And it's funny, whenever, you know, when they got the list, because I gave it to them post phone, they get, every kid I've given it to, they get very excited to cross things off. Mm. You know, they see it as this.
Well, that's what my daughter did. She was like, oh, I've already done that. I've already done that.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah. The kids love a challenge.
Yeah.
They love it. So it's a great kind of carrot. The book is a bit of a carrot towards getting something that they want. And they're excited to knock them off.
So is your youngest trying to complete the list then? Or
no, I think she's got them all.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, she went through it
except
with me.
For turn 14.
Except for turn 14, right, exactly.
Which she has no control over. Oh.
Well, and she's kind of 40 inside, so.
I get that. I have one of those too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But talk to me about the phone itself versus the social media apps. Because what if the kid has a phone that they use to call or text their parents for a ride home, but not the social media? Because sometimes I feel there is a line there where like the phone is helpful and useful in this day and age for communication, but maybe it's the social media that's bad.
Social media is a total, we could spend an hour on social media.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think video games too suck up a lot of hours.
Mm-hmm.
And
I wasted a lot of hours on Nintendo in my life, but I enjoyed it.
True.
I got good at it.
True,
right?
But it wasn't like with you everywhere, right?
That's
it wasn't
true.
With you at school,
you had
it wasn't
to be at
with
home.
You. Like,
yeah.
And whenever a kid gets uncomfortable, what I see them do is kind of dip into the technology. And I think facing that discomfort, you know, being alone in the world is a good skill. And you learn through experience how to deal with that. But things like GPS even, you know, I mean, I've seen adults get really dependent on GPS, not knowing how to get from one place to another.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there are lots of things. The phone's a Swiss Army knife. It's a great tool. But there's lots of things that we should probably be trying to do on our own as well. You know, navigating our neighborhoods, coping with boredom, et cetera.
What about the idea of delaying social media even longer? Because I have joked with my daughter. My daughter does have a phone, but she does not have any social media apps. And I told her she wasn't getting any until she was 25.
I think that's great guidance.
Yeah, and right. I'm serious about that. I know she's going to start negotiating it, but I told her I wasn't even going to consider negotiations until she's 16. But anyway, I joke about 25, but I feel it.
Yeah. I think one of my – it's funny because I don't have any social media, so I'm doing a terrible job promoting this book. But
hence the LinkedIn post. I got it.
Yeah. I mean, I keep LinkedIn just because of, you know, professional reasons, but yeah, when I talk to my kids about how they use social today, it's, they're not using it, as much as older generations, to socialize, if you will. I mean, Snapchat seems to be a communication device mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, where are you? How do we connect kind of thing? And TikTok is less of a social media device than it is kind of like a way to flip channels every 15 seconds, you know, to see content. So I'm hoping things change there. I'm definitely hoping kids can get out of that judgment zone,
mm-hmm.
which social seems to really do, judging themselves, judging other people. But I may have rose-colored glasses on that one.
Well, speaking of judgment, since you wrote this book, I'm sure other parents that you know have talked to you about it. And if their kid is under 14 and has a phone, do they like say, oh, let's not talk to Adam today?
Well, you know, I think the book can be used even after they get a phone, like mm-hmm. I do with my boys. It's just a great set of life skills and experiences that, you know, I was just talking to your producer as I walked in and she was like, I don't know how to play chess. And I was like, it's a really cool game.
Oh, that's number two.
It takes an hour or two to learn and
mm-hmm.
it's fun.
Do your kids have any favorite ones in here or ones did they offer you any suggestions, I guess, of what to add or, like whenever you were curating your 50?
No, I did not consult my children on any of this.
Okay.
I went back. A lot of them came from experiences that I had with them. Mm-hmm. So the visit to cemetery one was interesting. My son and I were taking a walk and ended up in a cemetery. And the conversation turned to, you know, life, souls, other people, where mm-hmm. do we go after all this? And it was a great, you know, it's not a conversation you have every day. But it was powerful and it stayed with me in my memory. I hope it did with him too.
Yeah. One that was interesting that just made me chuckle was the eat vegetarian for 1 week.
Yeah.
That's random.
Yeah. Well, it's a challenge. I mean, yeah. There's a couple of like knowing where your food comes from suggestions. So one mm-hmm. is, you know, catch a fish. Mm-hmm. Another one is grow a vegetable from seed. And that one, eat vegetarian for a week, just challenge yourself, you know, try to get through 1 week without eating, any animal products. See if you can do it. Every once in a while, we'll have, you know, a meatless dinner at my house, and it's great.
Yeah, and some of them are also practical, which is probably helpful. Besides do laundry, you have clean the bathroom. You know, just it's being a part of your household. That's
absolutely
what you're getting at.
Yeah, and cleaning the bathroom was a specific choice because it's kind of gross, and it's important for kids to kind of touch that, you know.
They contribute to it. They should have to help clean it up, right?
That's right.
So what's been the reaction like to your book? What do you hear from people about it?
I just think parents are searching for solutions.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it's this is a bite of the apple. It's not the Holy Grail. But I think a lot of parents have said how, you know, things that they didn't know how to do themselves, such as, you know, maybe they've never grown a vegetable from seed. They got to do that alongside their child and kind of bond with them, you know, and have that experience. So it's an activity. It's a little bit of an activity book, but it comes at a critical time in a kid's life. And my hope is that we can just use it or a practice like it to interrupt that digital handoff.
Can you write part two for an elementary school kid that is the things you have to do before I buy you a watch? A smartwatch.
I've heard the things you have to do before I get you a car, before I send you to college,
You could have a whole series here.
That's right.
But yeah, the younger kids, a lot of them have watches or all want them because their friends have them. So that might be your next book there.
Yeah. There you go.
Well, we have been talking with Adam Ferguson from Upper Arlington, and he's written a new book called The Things You Have to Do Before I Buy You a Phone. Thanks for being here, Adam.
Thanks, Amy.
And this has been Fascinating Ohio from All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.